Weekend companion at home or on the road. Your host right now, Brad Crandall. Band leader Freddie Martin, about 3 minutes from now, offers some interesting comparisons about the big band business, past and present, based on his first-hand observations while touring. Monitor Music first, by Jamie and the J. Sylvia Singers.
I see that worried look upon your face. You've got your troubles, I got mine. She's found somebody else to take her place. You got your troubles, I got mine. I too have lost my love today. All of my dreams have gone away. Now just like you, I sit and wonder why. You got your troubles, I got mine. You need some sympathy, well, so do I. You got your troubles, I got mine. She used to love me, that I know. And it don't seem so long ago. I seem unkind. You got your troubles, I got mine. I'd hope another place, another time. You got your troubles, I got mine.
There, Sally, what's wrong?
Oh, Mommy, I'm so sunburned.
Oh, poor darling. Mother will fix that sunburn right away. We'll just take this Solatane spray and spray here and here.
It feels so nice and cool.
Now, once more. How does your sunburn feel now?
The pain's all gone, Mommy.
Know why? Solatane puts your pain nerves to sleep.
Yes, child or adult, when the sun burns tender flesh, quick. Stop sunburn pain with Solarcane. Solarcane stops sunburn pain faster, more completely than ordinary first aids. Contains pain-killing benzocaine used by doctors. Actually stops sensation of pain itself. Dozens of uses. Stops pain and sting of detergent hands, minor kitchen burns, little cuts. Use Solarcane year-round. Get lotion, cream, or spray today. Stop sunburn pain with Solarcane.
Recognize that one? Well, if you have fond memories of the dance orchestras of the 30s and 40s, you'll easily identify it as Tonight We Love, the musical signature of one of the most popular dance bands of all time, Freddie Martin's orchestra. Well, Mr. Martin still coaxes golden sounds out of his tenor saxophone these days and still coaxes dancers onto the floor. He covers both the past and the future in a brief visit with Monitor reporter Jack Eichen.
I think when they say what happened to the big bands, I think that the Freddie, I think the remote broadcasts, the fact that they stopped broadcasting the big bands from different spots, that kind of hurt a little bit. Is that right?
Yes, it certainly did, Jack. And I started in your hometown of Brooklyn with my first band at the Bossert Hotel. And we started right out broadcasting, and this was one of the things that made the bands what they were in those days, was the fact that we had those remote broadcasts, and people could hear us from coast to coast. And if you had something on the ball, if you had an unusual style, it didn't take the public long to find out. And this is what makes it so tough today for anybody that would like to have a band, or would like to start again, or start out. They don't have the remotes to publicize them, or to or the record companies to get behind them.
Freddie, you've heard the question many, many times, I'm sure. Will the big bands come back? And how do you feel about that, Freddie? Do you think that that was another era and that was a period or what?
Well, it was an era. And as long as people want to dance, we'll still be in demand, those of us who are still running our orchestras. And there are not many of us left. Of course, we miss the great artists like Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy Dorsey and Glenn Miller, Eddie Howard. If we had those people still around today, I think it would be a better band business than it is. But there is a great demand. I myself do not have an open date until late in 68 right now. And this is as good as any period that I've had in the last 35 years.
Do you feel that as you travel around the country, Freddie, do you feel that people are starting to dance more?
Oh, very definitely we feel it. And I left the Coconut Grove about a year ago to accept a contract in Las Vegas where I'm spending about 6 months of the year. And we were playing in a room there on the top of the Dunes Hotel, which is strictly for dining and dancing. There's no gambling up there. And they're standing in line every night to get in. And it seems today that we're getting a lot of people who whose children have finally grown up, become 18 or 19. They're going off to school, and they can get out of the house now and go out dancing again, and they're just loving it.
Freddie, how do you account for the fact that you, Lombardo, Harry James, Woody Herman, have been able to keep going without a stop?
Just lucky, I guess.
You think that's it, or did,
no.
did you make enough money to sustain you through a few bad years?
No, it wasn't that. I've never had any bad years. I had a very lucky break, I will say, in that I was at the Coconut Grove for 26 straight years.
Mm-hmm.
And if I wanted to go out on the road for 3 months or 4 months, we always had a place to come back and hang our hats, which a lot of bands didn't have. Some of the bands have to stay on the road 12 months a year, and they do. I mean, bands like Duke Ellington and Count Basie and the Glenn Miller Orchestra, they're on the road constantly. And I have done my share of those one-nighters, too, and I've had it as far as that's concerned. Today, doing a one-nighter or doing a series of them is a means of getting from one place to another, an economic means.
Who is the richest band leader in the world today? Is it Lombardo?
I would say the richest band leader is Lawrence Welk right now.
Lawrence Welk?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it's not what he makes on television, but the side effects, the fringe benefits of concerts and fairs.
What do you think is the success of Lawrence Welk, in your opinion?
Well, Jack, if I knew, I would go out and try to do it myself. You know, somehow or other, I think the public can identify with Lawrence Welk because he's a very humble guy, and he doesn't speak the king's English, and a lot of people don't either.
That's right, too. I've met many band leaders who say it's cool, crazy, and that's not the king's English either.
Band leader Freddie Martin clarifying the role of big bands in today's popular music. There are several marked comparisons between the recent riots in Newark and Detroit. A report on that 1 minute ahead, so stay on the monitor beacon.
Mom, beat the heat. Wetson's hamburgers are the thing to eat. Their French fries are also great with Wetson's creamy, refreshing thick shakes. At Wetson's in Lake Grove, New York, on Middle Country Road, at the corner of Hawkins Avenue and Stony Brook Road. Add to your summertime happiness. Help send an underprivileged child to a Catholic youth organization camp for 2 weeks. Mail your gift today to CYO Camps, 122 East 22nd Street, New York, 10010. Mrs. Lois Nikolai of Farmingdale won $1,000. Mrs. Carol Lines of Richmond Hill won $1,500. Mrs. Charlotte Coburn of Yonkers won $1,900. And Mrs. Angeline Needham of North Bergen won $2,000 by playing Fortune Phone with Sterling Yates on WNBC. Be a winner. Listen to Fortune Phone and make sure Sterling has your number. Fortune Phone, weekdays at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on WNBC. This is The Conversation Station, WNBC, New York.
Once again, Brad Grendel, monitor, and the time, 19 minutes after the hour. Federal troops have started their final and complete withdrawal from Detroit. In retrospect, the racial disturbances in both Newark and Detroit share several common elements. For a report, here is Bill Matney, NBC News, Detroit.
There are striking similarities in the rioting that ripped through Newark and Detroit. First, there was the almost pinpoint firebombing and looting of white-owned businesses in both cities. Untouched storefront restaurants, barbershops, and miscellaneous businesses proclaimed soul brother or Negro-owned shouted loud testimony that the targets in the black ghettos were the white merchants who suddenly had become unwanted. It is not insignificant that at the recent Black Power Conference in Newark, attended by super militants from cities across this nation, the one common philosophy freely expressed was that whitey must be driven from the black communities of America before the Negro can gain control of his own destiny and, theoretically, accelerate his own full participation in the fruits of a lush society unfettered by traditional white controls. There were statements, too, that the one way to get this message across would be through the use of black power, the torch, the gun, carefully planned guerrilla hit-and-run warfare. This is not to suggest that the deadly sniping in both cities was organized or carried out by super-militant black nationalists, but it is worth noting that every American major city was represented at that conference and that super-militant organizations across the country, at least in terms of communication, are linked in an unofficial network. The biggest dissimilarity in the two riots is that whites join Negroes in the looting, in the sniping, and in death by police guns. It was not unusual this week in Detroit to see whites and Negroes sitting on street curbs as buildings burned away, sharing beer or booty, both had looted. The final contrast provided by Detroit is what some Negro leaders have known for some time. The angry, young ghetto militant no longer considers the middle-class Negro his brother. Now he rejects him as a black turncoat and rejects established leaders like King, Wilkins, and the Urban League's Young as ineffective spokesmen who no longer understand or speak the desperate, rebellious language of the black ghetto. This is Bill Matney, NBC News, in Detroit.
Taste that beats the others go. Pepsi pours it on. Pepsi pours it on.
Today, people like their soft drinks cold, really cold. And that's when the taste of Pepsi-Cola really comes alive. Taste that beats the others cold. Pepsi pours it on.
Taste that beats the others cold. Pepsi pours it on.
Remember goldfish swallowing, telephone booth packing, and stay-awake marathons and things like that? All of them college fads or pranks. Well, the Brothers Four have a song here that just might be a candidate for future collegiate cut-ups, Walking Backwards Down the Road.
Walking backwards down the road, looking all around, never thought I'd find. That's why I'm walking.
Close-up of people and events, both at home and abroad. A priority training program in Vietnam. That story now from Howard Tuckner, NBC News, Saigon.
The chances of winning the pacification fight in South Vietnam, and perhaps the war itself, may depend largely on a priority project now underway. A detachment of combat specialists from the U.S. 1st Infantry Division has started to train a South Vietnamese regional force company. The recruits are receiving 17 weeks of basic training, the same given draftees in the United States. If the project works, Americans are expected to begin training South Vietnamese units all over Vietnam. If it doesn't work, Washington optimists, who now admit it will take at least 5 years to pacify South Vietnam, might have to up the estimate to 10 years. Without pacification, there can be no successful conclusion to this war. The current training program has the full backing of Secretary of Defense McNamara, who recently called for more efficient use of South Vietnamese forces. Of course, it is not General Westmoreland's fault that the South Vietnamese have contributed little to the fighting. American field commanders and their men simply do not trust the courage and loyalty of the South Vietnamese soldier, who in turn does not trust his commanders to remain with him when the bullets start flying. The recruits being trained by the Americans now belong to a regional force company. This is equivalent to a National Guard unit in the United States, but here in Vietnam, the responsibility of the regional troops is vital. They must protect the pacification workers, who are prime targets of the Viet Cong. Their protection so far has been virtually non-existent. 750 pacification workers have been killed or wounded in the last 6 months. So now, a detachment of 8 U.S. Army men have 17 weeks to see if they can make tough soldiers of men who may not necessarily feel the Saigon government is worth dying for. Failure might cost the Americans their own lives. They must remain with the recruit company for at least a month during its first assignment in the field. The Viet Cong will not wait long trying to prove that no matter what or how hard the Americans try, they cannot succeed in making effective fighters of men who simply may not believe in the fight. We can teach them and help them and encourage them, and we do, said the American master sergeant watching his Vietnamese recruits trying to get through an obstacle course. But, the sergeant added, we have no idea how they'll react in combat. We cannot train their hearts. Howard Tuckner, NBC News, Saigon.
Ring Around the World, another of our weekend series of close-ups of people and events, both at home and abroad.
Thank you.
Reuben Mitchell's Orchestra and Dardanella. Every weekend while you travel, make Monitor your driving companion on NBC stations throughout the nation. In Cocoa Beach, Florida, you can hear us on WRKT. All stations will sign in now, and then Monitor comes right back. I'm Brad Crandall.
Monitor travels along with you wherever you go this summer on the NBC Radio Network.
Mom beat the kitchen heat. Wetson's hamburgers are the thing to eat. Their French fries are also great with Wetson's creamy, refreshing thick shakes. At Wetson's in Lake Grove, New York, on Middle Country Road, at the corner of Hawkins Avenue and Stony Brook Road.
Next on Monitor, Henri René's orchestra and Man of La Mancha. Monitor 67, your best variety listening every weekend, everywhere. I'm Brad Crandall. Later this half hour, Ted Webb and Sport of Speed, latest word from the world of automobile racing. In 3 minutes, Mrs. Elliot Roosevelt gives us an intimate close-up of one of America's most famous family dynasties. What's the latest from Perry Como? This.
You look back to see if I look back. Saw the lightning striking there.
the very, very moment I look back to see if you look back. And you look back to see if I look back to see if you look back to see if I was looking at you.
Put your thirst on ice with a cold Pepsi Cola. Pepsi has the taste created for the cold, a taste that comes alive in the cold in a big, bold, inviting way. Taste that beats the others cold, Pepsi pours it on.
Taste that beats the others cold, Pepsi pours it on.
I Love a Roosevelt, a provocative title for a new book, but which Roosevelt? Not FDR this time, but one of the five famous Roosevelt children. Remember them at the White House? Austere Anna, the eldest. Smiling Jimmy, robust Elliot, FDR Jr., who looked so much like his father. John, the youngest and most reserved. One of the Roosevelt boys married a clever, curious, charming lady who may have come late on the scene but made up for lost time in research for her family book. Monitor welcomes the former Patricia Peabody, who since 1960 has been Mrs. Elliot Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt, welcome to Monitor.
Thank you.
Yours is a stable, happy marriage, so you don't mind my mentioning that you are the fifth Mrs. Elliot Roosevelt, right?
I was hoping you wouldn't use the word Elliot so that I could get $6.95 from all the people that wanted to find out which Roosevelt.
Oh, that's a thought. It never crossed my mind. Is that why the title is that way? Well, the first question which always comes to mind when one thinks in terms of marrying into such a family is, how did you happen to meet Elliot, for example? Were you at one of the swank balls somewhere along the eastern coast, or what?
I was engaged in the practice of selling real estate in Phoenix, Arizona. And I was looking at Elliot's house with the prospect of showing it to a very good client in the afternoon, and I thought he was in Colorado. He didn't know anybody was coming to see the house. He was taking a leisurely shower. I had been instructed by the maid to be sure and see the master bedroom and bath, and there you are.
I see.
The son of the president was so awe-inspiring, and I was so terrified and so petrified with fright at seeing this, well, I can't call it vision, come out of the shower when I knew there was nobody in the house, that I called him Mr. Rockefeller.
You didn't. That beautiful. You still hear about that, I assume.
So when I get mad at him, I say, all right, Mr. Rockefeller.
I see. And you never called Mrs. Roosevelt, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt,
no.
Mrs. Rockefeller, did you?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, now, when you first met Mrs. Roosevelt, what were your first impressions? I'm curious.
I had written her a letter a month prior to the time of our first meeting. And in this letter, I really poured out my heart. I told her how lucky I was to love Elliot and how happy I was to love him and how glad I was that she and I both shared a love for a son and a husband. And I expected this. I really expected her to clasp me in her arms and hug and kiss and
come bouncing down
noses
the stairs and the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
How do you do, my dear?
I see.
Did you have a nice trip? But I would say that within 6 or 8 months, and Elliot being a particular favorite of hers, I think she finally, unconsciously maybe, began to warm up.
Until then, it hadn't crossed your mind maybe that a mother with a son who's already had four rather unfortunate experiences might be a little cautious.
Mm-mm.
At that stage.
Never.
You mentioned at the very beginning of the book a line which, in a way, fascinated me when you said that the Roosevelts, as a family, tended to put kinship above all other obligations. You mentioned that Eleanor Roosevelt had, in effect, warned you about this when you joined the family.
Well, I think the Roosevelts have been imposed upon and have been subjected to so many public criticisms because of their name, because of their position, because of their father's responsibilities and theirs, because they were children of their father.
Now, this is something that's always fascinated the public because vast hereditary wealth has a certain fascination of some sort. Who, for example, of the five children would you say is the richest?
Franklin is probably the richest in dollars earned per year, and I would say Jimmy is probably the most secure. No, not the most secure, but the most Well, secure in a way, but not secure in knowing what will happen 5 years from now. Anna is really the most secure in that fashion. And Johnny is he'll always be able to take care of himself.
It seems reasonable to assume that the estate, which I assume was quite large, of Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt, that there would have been a special provision for Anna as the daughter, rather than the four boys.
Anna was left all of the cash for her mother's estate. Franklin was left the publishing rights for any unpublished manuscript or letters.
Uh-huh.
And Elliot was left his grandmother Hall's pink china, or what remained of it, beautiful Sevres china. Johnny was left... can't remember what Johnny was left. Jimmy was left the little silver lady bell and some other things, and Franklin was left a tapestry over the fireplace. It was a very interesting, very warm...
sentiment to the sons and cash to the daughter, because she's the one who's going to have...
Well,
the
old assumption that men make personal, a living, her clothing and her jewelry and everything.
What are, if you're free to tell me, what are Elliot's plans now?
Oh, he's going back into business.
Going back into business?
Making money.
He's not going to try and pursue politics?
Well, I think he's going to sort of put his ducks in a row and get his feet back under him and make some money so that we don't have to go in the hole every time we go into politics.
Yeah, one of the things most people don't realize is that political activity is a money drain on most people.
Oof. Well, I have yet to see the campaign where we came out ahead.
Mm-hmm. Patty Peabody Roosevelt, author of I Love a Roosevelt, just published by Doubleday.
Far. It's no matter, darling, where.